Ladies and gentlemen, sports fans alike, welcome to another edition of Bill Swirsky's Sports Talk Chicago, one of the couple, two, three best podcasts around. So sit back, grab yourself a cold one and a Pola sausage, park your keister in the French room, and listen to Bill Swirsky's Sports Talk Chicago.
In Chicago, you know that all sports rock. The Bears, Hawks, Bulls, Cubs, and Sox. Pick your favorite, you can choose, as long as the Packers lose. For everything you need to know, it's Bill Swirsky, Sports Talk Chicago. Bill Swirsky, Sports Talk Chicago.
Hey everybody, welcome to another edition of Bill Swirsky, Sports Talk Chicago. This is your host, Sean. On this episode, we have Cubs going to a Game 7 of the World Series. The Bears coming off a phenomenal win on Monday night. And the Blackhawks starting to turn things around. All this and more on this episode of Bill Swirsky Sports Talk Chicago. But first, I'd like to thank our sponsor, the Rockford IceHogs. If you're not familiar with the Rockford IceHogs, they're the AHL minor league affiliate of the Chicago Blackhawks. What does that mean for you? You get to see the stars of tomorrow today at family-friendly, affordable prices. Tickets starting in just the single digits. You can afford to take your whole family and enjoy it. It's very fan-friendly atmosphere. Family-friendly atmosphere. So check it out. Get your tickets for Brovember Night. Get your mustaches out for Brovember Night, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the beautiful BMO Harris Bank Center, Rockford, Illinois, 90 minutes from the city limits. Check them out at icehogs.com. I know this is the first show we've done since the World Series has started. I meant to do a show last weekend, but the Bears were playing Monday night, so it didn't really make sense because then wouldn't have been able to talk about the Bears. And I kind of want to talk about the Bears, especially after this big win. And I thought about just doing a show tomorrow, just to recap after the World Series is over. But no matter the outcome tomorrow, I'm not going to be in any shape to do a show. I'm either going to be bursting into tears with absolute tears of joy, or I'm going to be a miserable turd. One or the other. I don't want to do a show in either of those, situations. So we're going to talk about Cubs first, because I know that's what you guys all want to hear. We'll talk Bears, and then we'll wrap it up with Blackhawks. And I'm hoping to have a guest next week if I get a chance to actually reach out to them and see the their availability. But I would like to have a guest next week to talk a little bit about the Bulls and their hot start. So like I said, let's start first with the Chicago Cubs. And if you're listening to this, hopefully you're listening to it when it's tied 3-3 just after the sixth game of the World Series where the Cubs won 9-3. So we're going to have to go back a little bit because I really haven't talked to you guys since they beat Clayton Kershaw. But a few things I wanted to point out before we kind of go into the games is you have Javi Baez, who went from K artist to strikeout artist to MVP of the NLCS back to strikeout artist. It's like I think the kid just has a giant ego, and it kind of helps him to be who he is, but it also keeps him from reaching superstardom, if that makes any sense. I think he needs to have some level of that ego to do the things that he does, but he's got to keep it in somewhat of a check. And what you had is he got a little bit of a big head from how well he played against the Dodgers in the National League Championship Series, that it carried way too over into the World Series, and he went back with that high leg kick, and he thought he was going to be the World Series hero, and he struck out a lot. And finally, going into Game 6 is Joe Maddon. He can't take him out of the game because he needs his bat, or his glove in there, and the threat of his bat. And the Indians had a great game plan for him, is throw him curveballs and throw him things out of the zone and watch him swing, and swing away he is. He's not being selective with his pitches. He's getting two quick strikes, and then he's pressing and swinging at whatever comes his way. So Joe Maddon moved him down to ninth in the order, which for Javi Baez is a slap in the face, but sometimes he needs that slap in the face. Like when he got sent back down to the minors after he spent a big chunk of his rookie year in the majors, got sent back down to the minors the next year because they wanted him to work on things. And he just needs to be kept in check. But his glove is so good that the Cubs would not be where they are right now if it wasn't for Javi Baez's glove. And in the Dodgers series, his bat as well. So it's hard to be mad at him, but he just needs to keep... He needs to just remember they don't need him to hit home runs. They just need him to get on base, get singles, get walks. Take what they're going to give you. They're going to throw it outside in the zone. Just take those. Don't swing. That's one of my points. This has been ad nauseum, but the return of Kyle Schwarber, which was just an absolute shock to everybody. I mean, I remember hearing a report that there's a potential that he comes back, and I'm like, no way. This is just to play mind games with the Indians, because then they're going to be like, well, is he coming back? Is he not coming back? What's going on? And then he came back, and he's played really well. He's hit the ball well. It looked like he hasn't missed his stride at all. And going back to Chicago, I was like, oh, please let him be able to play the field, because they could use his bat, and doctors did not clear him to play in the field, so he could only play DH spot. And I think that really hurt the Cubs, because I think the Cubs have a much more potent lineup, a much more well-rounded lineup when he's in it. And I think the Cubs are World Series champions right now if he was able to play in those three games. I think they win that 1-0 game. I think they win that one. I think they win that 1-0 game if Jason Hayward's in there, because we'll get to that later. But Kyle Schwarber's return has been a huge boost, and I think it's funny, because you wouldn't expect the opposing team having home field advantage to be to your benefit. But for the Cubs, it really has been. They start on the road. They don't have the pressure of the fans. They came to Chicago and all the pressure was on. Anthony Rizzo talked about it, how he was feeling the nervous energy of the fans. And we're Chicago Cubs fans. That's what we do, is we exude nervous energy. It's just how we are. That's what we do. I mean, we've never been here in our lifetime. This is new. We don't know how to react, so we're just nervous. And maybe once we get a couple World Series rings, then that takes away the edge a little bit, like a stiff drink. But for right now, yeah, we're nervous. So it was a burden for the Cubs to be playing at Wrigley Field, which you wouldn't think so. So going back to Cleveland for games 6 and 7 were a huge boost, because they don't have... The fans that they have there are the different breed. They're the ones that are traveling. They're the ones that are just completely excited. The nervous energy fans, the local fans that are going just to the Wrigley games. Plus the fans that come the Chicago fans that come out to Cleveland, they're going to be drowned out a little bit by the number of Indians fans. But Cubs don't have that nervous energy. They get Kyle Schwarber back, which is a huge boost to them. And they know that they're facing a guy they can hit in game 6. So when the Cubs were down to 3-1, I pulled some stats, and I said, I'm not worried right now. This is still a series. I tweeted it. I said it on to other people. I made notes because I was planning to do a podcast, but I kept saying is, they're down 3-1. This is still a series. This is going 7 games. And here it is. It's going into game 7. And I pulled some statistics just really quickly. I went back and looked at the Cubs season. This includes the postseason as well as the regular season. The Cubs have had 18 streaks of three wins or more. 18. So this is nothing new, having to win three games in a row. They've done it 18 times in the season. That's a lot. So I broke it down. They had 8 3-game winning streaks, 5 4-game winning streaks, 2 5-game winning streaks, 1 6-game winning streak, 1 8-game winning streak, and 1 11-game winning streak. So this is not new territory to the Cubs. Having the pressure on them, not new. These kids, they're not feeling it right now, especially with all the momentum. They've done it. They've been able to win multiple games in a row. They've been able to beat pitchers. Think about it, is they went and they didn't. They went out and they beat Johnny Cueto. They went out and made Madison Bumgarner ineffective. They beat Clayton Kershaw. Now it's Corey Kluber. And Corey Kluber is on so much short rest. I guess we'll get to that soon too. What else? And I said after the Indians went up 3-1, and I said, watch, what's going to happen is everyone keeps saying that the Cubs have to win three. And I kept saying, I was like, no, they have to win two, and then game seven is just it's a toss-up. It's really a toss-up. Anything can happen. Anything can happen in a game seven. This is the craziness of sports. So they really had to win two. That last game at Wrigley, game five, they won. They won that game, and they brought it to 3-2. Okay, so now they go back to Cleveland. They're still down 3-2, but they're going into Cleveland. And Cleveland, mentally, if you think about it logically and mentally, it's not a big deal. They've got Corey Kluber pitching game seven, and whatever they get out of Tomlin, they get. If they win it, they great. If they don't, they don't have to fret. Conserve everything for game seven. Don't get too high, don't get too low from this game. But that's much easier said than done. The Indians, this is the worst possible thing that could happen to the Indians. On the other hand, this is a great thing. But again, we'll get to that a little more later. But like I said, the point I was trying to make is that the Cubs going to Cleveland didn't have the pressure on them. They didn't have the pressure. The pressure is all on Cleveland right now. They were up 3-1. 3-1. Statistically, there's no way they should lose. This is no way. Like, all the Vegas money is on. All the history is on them to win. The Cubs had nothing to lose. They won game five. Then they win game six. Now it's onward to game seven. And the Cubs are playing with house money right now. So the pressure is all on Cleveland. So let's talk about game one quickly. Is Cleveland won that one 6-0, as we know. And Corey Kluber was pitching on full rest. Actually, extended rest. Cleveland scored early, and they continued that trend where I didn't actually go look at the box scores, but apparently throughout the ALCS and the NLCS, whoever scored first won the game. This continued with game one of the World Series. Cleveland scored first. They won the game. The Cubs, Corey Kluber was given a really wide strike zone, and his stuff was just filthy. So it was a double whammy for the Cubs hitters. And they basically drew 2 walks in the whole game, which is a bad sign for them. They were 1-for-11 with runners in scoring position and left 9 guys on base. Grimm and Rondon had absolute meltdowns. John Lester pitched okay. 5 2/3, 6 hits, 3 earned runs, 7 strikeouts. And for the Indians, Lindor went 3-for-4, Ramirez went 3-for-4, and Perez went 2-for-4 with 2 home runs. And all the talk was the Indians are going to, they were at the top of the league in stolen bases, and they're going to steal bases all day long on John Lester because John Lester doesn't throw to first, and there's nothing they could do. And for all that talk, the Indians stole one base. They were 1-for-2 in stolen base attempts. Lindor got caught stealing once, and he stole one base. So it's not like they ran around on Lester. So that wasn't the big issue. But after the game, game two was Arrieta's turn to pitch. He wins the game 5-1. Cubs take game two, tied up 1-1. Arrieta's command looked pretty miserable. But after the game, kind of alluded to this a minute ago, is after the game, Chris Bosio, the Cubs pitching coach, said it's not that he was being really wild. It's that they had the catcher purposely setting up elsewhere from where Arrieta was going to be throwing the ball because they felt that the Indians were stealing signs. And I don't know if that was a tactic to narrow out the strike zone or what, or if the Indians were actually doing it, but that was a tactic the Cubs took because they felt the Indians were stealing signs. But Arrieta goes 5 2/3, a two-hitter. Going into the sixth, he had a no-no going, but he gave 2 hits, 1 earned run, 6 strikeouts. And then Montgomery and Chapman came in and shut the game down and pitched the rest of the game. Schwarber had some great offense for the team and helped them win this. But again, the Cubs were pretty atrocious in leaving runners in scoring position. They were 3-for-12 with runners in scoring position, and they had 13 men left on base. Not very good. But they drew 8 walks as a team, which is much more aligned to when they win games. They chased Trevor Bauer from the game in the 4th inning. Because Andrew Miller pitched a lot in game 1, they didn't see Andrew Miller in game 2, which has helped them with that win. Game 3, Cleveland wins 1-0 in Wrigley Field. The Cubs, again, 1 walk, 5 hits. No Kyle Schwarber. 0-for-7 with runners in scoring position. Leaves 7 guys on base. Hendricks looked great, but the Cubs couldn't hit Tomlin. And for the most of the season, Tomlin was a really hittable pitcher, and the Cubs just couldn't do anything because he was throwing so many curveballs that the Cubs hitters couldn't do anything with. The one run that was scored was you had Soler, who couldn't come in on a little bloop single that scored. And you started Soler in right field ahead of Jason Hayward. And I guarantee you, Jason Hayward makes that play. It wasn't that hard of a play to make. Jason Hayward makes that play, holds the runner. The Cubs don't give up anything there. And Soler had the opportunity in that game to get that run back. Is he hit a fly ball that should have been foul out of play along the right field line, foul line, but the wind kept it in play right along that weird wall that Wrigley Field has, that's like the foul wall. And the right fielder is watching it, and then just missed it and falls fair. And if you watch from the one angle, you can see Soler just jogs out of the box thinking it's going to be a foul ball. Then he picks it up a little bit as he's rounding first because he's like, oh, this is going to get caught. And then when he sees it drop, then he turns and he ends up with a triple. Had he just run out of the box, that's an inside the park home run. It's tied 1-1. We have a different ball game than we have there. And the Cubs definitely had their opportunities to score more runs, but that was just bad. It was bad. And it's even more pronounced when this isn't the first time it's happened. Is Javier Baez had a situation like that. Wilson Contreras had a situation like that. Is these guys are not hustling. This is the World Series. This is the World Series. You can't be lollygagging it, especially after you've had teammates have bad situations on the field because of their lollygagging and get called out in the media and by coaches, and for Soler to still do it, that was just stupid. It was just plain stupid on Soler's part. But that game hurt. That game really hurt. That should have been a victory. But that's neither here nor there right now. Game four, this is when the wheels fell off. Cleveland wins 7-2. The Cubs scored first, and this was actually the first game from the league championship series on where the team that scored first didn't win. So the Cubs scored first, which is a really good sign, but Lackey just didn't have it. The Cubs, rather than pitching everybody on short rest, decided to go with four starters, and John Lackey just didn't look good. And it wasn't helped that Chris Bryant had two errors, throwing errors. That was bad. But John Lackey talked about big boy games, and this was a big boy game right here. It's the World Series. Your team is down 2-1. You already lost a game at home. So you won by winning game two. You took home field advantage away from the Indians, and you lose it in game three. So you need to make sure you don't lose any more games at home, and you go out there in a big boy game and you pitch like garbage. It's not good. The Cubs faced Corey Kluber for the second time because he's pitching. He pitched game four on short rest, and he's going to pitch game seven on short rest. But Corey Kluber, the Cubs hit him better than they did, but they still couldn't score any runs, and they only drew one walk on him. Cubs were 1-for-7 with runners in scoring position and left six guys on base. Grimm and Montgomery didn't look good in that game. And the big question was, why didn't they take Lackey out earlier in that game to pinch hit Kyle Schwarber? Because he was available as a pinch hitter. So you had him as a one-time weapon. He got one at-bat in that game. You needed to make it count, and they didn't do it. Game five was another situation like that. The Cubs ended up winning 3-2, but it was on the bat of Chris Bryant with the home run. And it started a huge fourth inning for the Cubs. But again, they were not good with runners in scoring position. 3-for-10 with 8 left on base. Let Lester pitch really well, but he only pitched 6 innings. And you brought Chapman in for an 8-out save. He had 4 strikeouts, and he even batted, which he actually looked fairly decent up there. He looked stout, like he was going to crush one out of the park. But that was huge, and it was 40-some pitches that Chapman had. It was 2 pitches away from the most he's ever pitched in a game before. So that's... You had to do that because you were down 3-1 at that point. So you win that game. You win by one run. Chapman shuts everybody down, and you win 3-2. And you got to take any win at that point you can get. And then come to game six, is you get out to an early big lead. You're up 7-0. They catch up a little bit, 7-2. And you decide to bring in Aroldis Chapman in the seventh to get the heart of their order out. So they're 4, 5, and 6 guys. I get it. I get that's why you do it, because baseball is changing as a sport. It used to be the closer came in the ninth. But what's in the ninth, if you get everybody out, they're going to have their 7, 8, and 9 hitters up. So it's the bottom of the order. You need to get them out and crush any momentum that they have by getting out their 4, 5, and 6. Is they're way more likely to score runs with their 4, 5, and 6 guys in the 7th and 8th than they are by with being down by 5 with your 7-8-9 hitter up. It's just a fact. So I get that. I get you bring in Chapman, but they didn't have anybody warming up, and they brought him back for the ninth. And especially after Rizzo hit a 2-run homer to make it 9-2 at that point. So it's a 7-run lead in the ninth. So they've got 3 outs to get at least 7 runs. And you don't think you can do that with the guys you have? You can't bring in Travis Wood. You can't bring in CJ Edwards. You can't bring in any of these guys to get you 3 outs with a 7-run lead. That's bad. So if you're the Cubs, you won this battle, but is it going to hurt you in the war? Because now, in a 3-day span, on Sunday, you had Chapman pitch 40-some pitches, and then he throws another 20 on Tuesday. Is he going to be available on Wednesday to throw more than to maybe 1 or 2 batters? I don't know. I get it's game 7 and it's all hands on deck, and you don't worry about somebody getting injured, because if they do, the season doesn't start again until April. You've got a long time to heal up. And he's a free agent anyway. And you've also got John Lester available to come out of the bullpen, and you've got John Lackey available to come out of the bullpen. So you've got Hendricks, who's capable of pitching a complete game. You've got Lester and Lackey and Chapman, and you still got bullets in your tank with Mike Montgomery and Travis Wood. It's trust anybody else. So they get the big win, but it came at a cost. So game 7 is going to come down to possibly the National League and the American League Cy Young winners, and Corey Kluber and Kyle Hendricks, and it's going to be an exciting game. Cleveland, although they just got battered and beat, they sat in that dugout and they didn't look intimidated, which you would hope they would. You'd hope that confidence was shaky, and I think somewhere deep down they're like, you know what, we had a 3-1 lead, we're at home, we gotta close this out, we have to, and they've got to be feeling the pressure. But it's got to be good to know you have Corey Kluber with Andrew Miller ready to go at a moment's notice. But if you listen to the announcers and you listen to Pete Rose and you listen to Frank Thomas, they'll talk all day long about how Joe Maddon made a mistake by the amount that they pitched Aroldis Chapman in this game with a 7-run lead. But nobody is mentioning that Corey Kluber is pitching again on short rest. So he pitched game 4 on short rest. He's pitching game 7 on short rest as well. And he's pitched not a lot of innings, but he had a lot of pitches in those games. Is he going to have any ill effects? We saw the ill effects on Clayton Kershaw in that elimination game against the Cubs. Are we going to see the same Corey Kluber that mowed the Cubs down in game 1? My thinking is Cubs saw him that first time. He mowed him down. They didn't know what to expect, and they just, with a wide strike zone and just filthy stuff, they nothing they can do. They watched tape. They saw him once through. They came back the second time they saw him, and they fared much better. Still not very good, but much better. Game this third time, they've seen him. They know what he's got. He's going to have tired arm. You're not going to see him out there for very long. You're going to see Andrew Miller. And the Cubs got to Andrew Miller. They may not have scored runs, but they were able to draw walks. They were able to get contact. And this is going to be interesting. Let's see, some other notes that I want to talk about before we wrap this up and move to Bears. As bad as Jason Hayward is at the plate, he's the best alternative that the Cubs have right now in right field, which is kind of scary. I wrote this before game 6, is they need to burn out Aroldis Chapman if necessary, because it doesn't matter. He's a free agent. If not to be a jerk, but if he gets hurt, it's not your problem anymore. He's a free agent. Who from the bullpen is actually going to step up besides Chapman? And that's a big question. Joe Maddon doesn't know the answer to that. How many innings in relief can John Lester pitch in Game 7? Baez forgot how to hit. We talked about that. The offense was slumping at the wrong time, but they seem to be turning it around now with Russell getting six RBIs and a grand slam. You have Anthony Rizzo going, 3 for 4 or 3 for 5 with a home run. You had Chris Bryant with 4 for 5 with a home run. So the heart of your lineup starting to hit, and you don't worry about Kyle Schwarber as much because he's just looked super steady. Even when he's not getting hits, he just looks like he's not struggling. And nothing looks like a struggle to him, even when he's struggling. I wrote that the stage seemed really big for the Cubs, and I think a lot of that was just the pressure being at home and being in the World Series, that everybody felt that they needed to do more than they needed to do. So I felt like the young Cubs players, the stage was a little bit big for them. Finally, the stage seems to be getting smaller, and they are rising up to go front and center. So that's a good thing. I wrote that the Cubs, this was before Game 6, the Cubs need one guy to be on fire, a la Murphy last year for the Mets, to carry that offense through their slumps. And it seems like Chris Bryant wants to be that guy. Hopefully, a couple of other guys want to go with him, like Schwarber and Zobrist and Rizzo, and hopefully Fowler. But the Cubs need at least one guy to be on fire to help lead them. If they're able to get to Corey Kluber and put some runs on him, that makes it much better for them facing Andrew Miller, because then the pressure is on him to preserve the lead or to hold the Cubs back rather than trying to preserve a lead. It's a lot more stressful. I wrote, if Javi Baez was the same Javi Baez we saw in the National League Championship Series, the Cubs win Game 3 and head to Cleveland up 3-2 rather than down to 3-2. All the pressure is on Cleveland at home with Tomlin with a 4.4 ERA versus Arrieta, who's the reigning Cy Young winner, and blank them. So I was already confident in my notes. And the Cubs players just have to follow Joe's mantra, try not to suck. And one more thing I want to say about this is, it's funny because Joe Maddon says all the right things before the games and after the games, and he sounds cool as a cucumber. But if you watch that man in this series, he seems so rattled. Like, the pressure is getting to him right now. And I don't know if it's just his lack of faith in this bullpen or the fact that the Cubs have had so many slumps of hitting in the postseason, but he just doesn't look confident. And I hope that's just the perception he's giving off, and he has a calm demeanor in the clubhouse, because you can't let these kids get spooked and rattled. You need them to stay strong. You need them to keep hitting, because this is Game 7 tomorrow, and that's all or nothing. You're either World Series champions, or it's the old saying is maybe next year. So let's go, Cubs. I'm confident. I think they get to Kluber. Kluber's arm's going to be a little tired. They will have seen him enough. And it's going to come down to, can the Cubs bullpen hold them at the end of the game and hold the lead that they get? That's going to be the big question. Bears. We had another primetime game, which I was so annoyed with, because they've played so badly in their Thursday nights and their Sunday nights and all their other primetime games. This is their fourth primetime game, so like half the season has been primetime games. But this game looked a lot different. They finally came out and showed what's up. And it's funny, because this week a report came out that the Bears ownership had brought in a consultant to evaluate everything that's going on inside the organization And that can't feel good if you're the general manager and you're the head coach. And they've avoided any questions that people have asked about it. In fact, after the game, when Fox was asked about it, he ended the press conference. Now, normally I would say, all right, it's kind of a dick move to do that at the press conference after they just won a huge game on Monday night. But John Fox is so dodgy about answering questions and treating media with respect that, good, if he's not going to answer hard-hitting questions, he only wants to answer fluff questions, then he's going to get them whenever he's mandated to be there to answer questions. And that's what he did. He finally was up there and mandated by the NFL that he has to answer questions, and he gets a tough one that he doesn't want to answer. And Ryan Pace is not much better. I think Ryan Pace is a good evaluator, and I think he's going to end up being a fairly decent GM. As far as dealing with the media, he's awful. I put in a request with the Bears organization to have John Fox, to have Ryan Pace on, and I just got a condescending email back. I was like, you could have just said he's not available, but, you know, they're just so anti-media in this organization right now, in this regime. But I'm sorry, I'm on a tangent. So going in, the Vikings, other than that loss to the Eagles, looked like they were one of the best two or three teams in the NFL. And the Bears look like they're one of the two or three worst teams in the NFL. You expected the Vikings to come in and just stifle the Bears, who finally got Jay Cutler back. And I mentioned this last week when Brian Hoyer got hurt and you had Matt Barkley. I said, watch Monday. If the Bears don't sign a veteran quarterback Monday, that means Jay Cutler will be starting that game. If they sign a veteran quarterback on Monday, Matt Barkley will be starting that game. And they didn't sign anybody Monday, so you knew it was Cuddy going to be there. They might have ho-hummed and hemmed and hawed about, well, he might be ready, we'll see. If they didn't sign a veteran on Monday, it was Jay Cutler, 100%. And that's what you had. So you had this like stellar Vikings defense going up against the Bears offense that's great between the 20s but can't score points. Jay Cutler coming back. Is he going to be rusty? Is he going to throw interceptions? And you're missing your starting two guards. Josh Sitton not playing again. Kyle Long not playing again. So you had Eric Kush and Ted Larson filling in. So it's like, all right, with two backup guards in there and your quarterback that hasn't played in a month and a half, this is not going to be good. And it was not the story at all. I took some notes, and the biggest thing I wrote down and I circled it and I kept circling and starring it throughout the game was clearly the Bears watched the tape of the Eagles versus the Vikings and they saw something in there. And it's funny because I wrote this down and I was like, this is a point. I know this. I heard an interview earlier this afternoon with Jordan Howard, and he basically said flat out that we saw some things in the tape of the Eagles game that made us do what we did to be able to run the ball. And that it was clearly evident that the Bears saw a hole that they exploited, and they kept exploiting and they kept exploiting until the Vikings either stopped it or the Bears won the game. And I loved that aggressive attitude. That's something that Bill Belichick does. Bill Belichick will run the same play over and over and over again until you can put your big boy pants on and stop it. If you don't stop it, why is he going to switch it up and try to outsmart you? He's going to keep doing something that works. He's going to keep running that same play until it stops working. And the Bears saw what they did, and they just hammered at the running game, and Jordan Howard looked great. And overall, the Bears just played a great game. It was a clean game. They They played whistle to whistle. They only had, I think, three penalties in the whole game. They had an unsportsmanlike conduct. They had a defensive offsides, and they had a false start. So they eliminated penalties for the most part. They really eliminated pre-snap penalties. They didn't turn the ball over at all. And they were I'm efficient isn't the right word. Is they were efficient plus, I guess. Is they were efficient with it and then made plays when they had to. So think about the 69-yard run by Jordan Howard. Think about that shovel pass that Jay Cutler had. You think about some of the footwork things that he did to extend plays. Those are the things that they did. I guess we'll talk about the Bears' offensive line first. The Vikings' defense should have gotten to Jay a lot more than they did, and they were able to collapse the pocket a little bit. But for the most part, the Bears' offensive line held fairly strong, especially the interior three. Cody Whitehair had a great game. Eric Kush and Ted Larson had pretty good games. It was a quiet game at right tackle by Bobby Massey. But again, Charles Leno Jr. didn't look good at left tackle. That's got to be a position of upgrade for the Bears because he just didn't look good. And that was the one weak spot on that offensive line in this game. Wide receivers is Cameron Meredith looked good. I'm going to lump in Zach Miller as a wide receiver, and he looked good. You had Alshon Jeffrey, drew a lot of coverage, and he makes your offense better by being on the field. But in the first half, he had so many drop passes that hit him right in the hands that it was kind of embarrassing. And Jay Cutler came in, and he was very efficient with the ball. He protected it, no interceptions. He looked good. He extended plays. He rolled out, looked mobile. So they had him rolling out, throwing in some nice passes. And if you didn't watch the game closely, you completely missed the reason why Jay Cutler is a better quarterback than Brian Hoyer. Brian Hoyer, the things I love about Brian Hoyer is he spreads the ball around. He gets the ball to all kinds of receivers. Doesn't throw interceptions. He's able to make all his reads. But he's so careful with the ball that he misses plays. There's things where you should, as a quarterback in the NFL, if you're going to go out there and win, at some point you have to say, that's a small hole, a small window in the defense. I'm going to hit it. Now, you can't be too blasé about it, but you have to know your talents and trust them. Tom Brady is what makes him great, is he knows what he can do, and he knows what he can't do, and he pushes the limit of what he can do and hits it. Jay Cutler is willing to do that, and Brian Hoyer's not. If somebody doesn't have a big wide open window for him to hit, he's not throwing it. He's not going to do it. And when you're from the 20 to the 20, the field is pretty big field. You've got these openings. You can get guys open. When you get into the red zone, the closer you get to the goal line, is the field gets smaller and smaller and smaller. It's harder to be wide open. If you're not throwing to wide open guys, and the running game gets a lot harder to gain yards, then you're just settling for a lot of field goals. Jay's been able to get touchdowns. Running backs is you had Kadeem Carey got a few carries in there. You got Jeremy Langford back, but Jordan Howard got the start, and he looked fantastic. There's been a couple games in there where he didn't look so good, but he's a guy, when you watch him run, he needs to get a little bit of ahead of steam. Once he gets that head of steam, he's able to do some juke moves. He's able to hit you and bowl you over. He's able to do a lot more things, but when he's getting hit in the backfield or they're getting hands on him in the backfield and he doesn't get that head of steam, it's a lot harder for him to to do anything. And the Bears' offensive line wasn't helping him out the last couple weeks. This time is they gave him a little bit of daylight, and he took it. He was able to get to the second level with a head of steam, and he was taking guys out and dragging guys, and he was getting big chunks of yards. And you finally saw what his Achilles heel is on that 69-yard run is he ran out of gas, and he doesn't have home run speed. The Bears used play action passing well. I think their offensive game plan was pretty good. Jay, for the first time in a long time, you watched him distribute the ball to a lot of different guys, not just force it to Alshon Jeffrey every time. There was one where it was I can't tell if it was a bad pass or if it was a miscommunication between the receiver and the quarterback, but it looked like it was going to be an interception and probably a pick six, a return for a touchdown, and Alshon Jeffrey broke it up and knocked the ball out of the defensive back's hands, saving an interception and possibly a touchdown. That was great. You had the play, like I said, the play action was working because you were able to sustain a running game. That's huge. If you're not running the ball, you don't make the play action believable. With the play action, it's not about just faking the run. It's about freezing linebackers and freezing safeties and being able to create mismatches based on that. If you don't have anybody that's worried about your running game, they're not going to buy on that play action. So by the Bears running the ball really well, that made the play action that much more potent. See, Alshon Jeffrey, I don't think he had a catch in the first half. He was 0 for 4 in attempts thrown to him. Great play calling by both coordinators, but I will talk about Dow Loggins now. I thought he called a great game. You want, with the Bears, you wanted to run the ball a lot more than you do. Even in games where they've been closer with the run-pass balance, it's still been way more skewed to the pass game than it is to the run game. In this game, you finally saw the Bears really went run-heavy and made the Vikings pay. See, Alshon Jeffrey got his first catch. It was the first ball thrown in the second half. But it's funny because he had a complete blatant push-off on the defensive back, and they didn't call it. That touchdown pass to Alshon, that would not have been a touchdown if Brian Hoyer was in the game, because Brian Hoyer wouldn't have thrown that pass. And again, that was another one that was brought on by the play action. Jordan Howard looked great, like I keep saying, but it's not just that he was one-dimensional. Is you could see him running power formation between the A gap and the B gap. You saw him run those. You saw him do end-around, sweep plays where he's able to get to the corner and go around with show a little bit of speed. He was doing it all. He looked fantastic out there. And finally, is by sustaining a running game, you were able to put a dagger on in that game and close it out by killing the clock. And that was fantastic, because there's been so many games where the Bears, just when they need to kill 3 minutes off of three or 4 minutes off of the clock to win the game, they go out there and throw three passes and don't get a first down and have to punt. This time they actually they kept time of possession in their favor. They ran the ball, they ran the clock out, and they looked great. I think if this game goes another quarter, the Vikings have a real chance of winning, even though the Bears dominated them the whole game. But the Bears shut that door on them and didn't give them the opportunity. Defensively, the Bears looked good. And I know a lot of it has to do with the fact that there's no Adrian Peterson. The Vikings have no run game whatsoever. It's bad. The Bears didn't have to worry about the Vikings breaking off big run plays. So they were able to focus strictly on the passing game. they didn't bite into play action like the Vikings did to the Bears, that they were biting on those play action passes. The Bears didn't bite on them because they don't care. The Vikings hand off, that's just a free down for the Bears. They get 1-2 yards, if that, and it's almost like a sack. You saw gang tackling on the runs every time that the Vikings would hand off. You'd see multiple Bears there making tackles, which is something you saw in the heyday of Lovey. The Bears exploited the fact that the right and the left tackle for the Vikings are awful. You saw three of the worst tackles in the league in this game in Long, Clemming, and Charles Leno Jr. And the Bears just exploited the fact that they couldn't stop them on the edges by sending basically a nonstop barrage of Pernell McPhee and Leonard Floyd. And both of those guys looked great. It was nice to see the two of them on the field at the same time because they give you a different style of getting to the quarterback. Pernell McPhee is much more physical and dominating that way. Leonard Floyd is finesse and speed. And he finally started to look like he's coming into his own. I mean, you saw flashes of it for the last few weeks, and you saw a lot more against the Packers, that loss. But then you started to see it, what the potential that the Bears saw in him in this game, and that's great. Again, your defensive backs, you're down to a lot of the bottom of the barrel as far as what you have. You started three cornerbacks in this game, and that was the veteran Porter, and then Devontae Bosby, and Cravion LeBlanc. So you're starting two young scrubs and an old Porter who's a mediocre cornerback, and you're getting the job done. Like I said, you saw the athleticism of Floyd when in that the first quarter when he chased Bradford and caught him from behind, and you just saw the athleticism. You saw what the Bears coaching staff and general manager saw in those college tapes, is that this is the guy that they wanted. And they're finally stopping him from dropping into coverage every time, and they're letting him go and get to the quarterback. Forced a lot of bad passes that way. You also saw when they were not getting pressure, which they got a lot of pressure with the front guys, is they were getting their hands up and tipping a lot of balls. That's something that they haven't really done a lot this season, is if you can't get to the quarterback, tip the ball, block his line of sight, do something to disrupt the clean pocket. What else? One thing I wanted to mention was that huge 69-yard run that Jordan Howard had. That was against an 8-man front. They put an 8th man in the box just to stop him, and he still got that. He burned right through their front line, made it to the second level, and then took it from there. So that was fantastic to see. Akeem Hicks had a really big game. It was nice to see that he's coming into his own. And I don't know if, you know, what lit a fire in his butt, but he looked good, and he was dominating. The Bears weren't buying the Vikings' play action, which made them really one-dimensional. And the Vikings' offense, on top of being really one-dimensional by not being able to have a running game, is their play calling was really predictable. And the Bears took advantage of that. And the funny thing is it was a lot like looking in a mirror, because this is what we see a lot as Bears fans from our team, is the team goes, can't do one thing, so they become one-dimensional and very predictable in their play calling, and just nothing is working. And it's a long day when you can't score points and you can't move the ball. And I felt for the Vikings because it was like looking in a mirror for a lot of Bears games. Yeah, there was a few plays that the Bears defense looked pretty good, but that secondary still has some holes in it, and they still have bad safety play. There was a play that was it was just missed a home run pass from Sam Bradford to Stephon Diggs, and Porter was absolutely beat, and there was no help over the top for him. And luckily, it was just a bad, poorly thrown pass. Otherwise, you know, that's a touchdown and things change in the game. The pressure by the Bears defense made the Bears defensive backs look much better than they are because they didn't have to protect him as long. And they weren't giving a clean pocket to Sam Bradford to step up and throw. He was throwing on the move, throwing on the run, and throwing under pressure. Pernell McPhee and Leonard Floyd just looked dominant out there. And you had some great play calling by Vic Fangio. And the Bears took advantage of Vikings penalties to preserve drives and to keep them letting them stall their own drives and not bailing them out with penalties of your own. So that was good to see. The one real downfall of this game was you had an absolute bonehead play by Cornelius Washington where you kept the drive alive by coming out on the field that you're not supposed to be in that play, and you come out on the field and you get an unsportsmanlike conduct. It keeps the drive alive and you end up scoring. The Vikings end up scoring. That was just an absolute boneheaded play that the Bears can't have. They can't have boneheaded plays and win games. They've got to keep playing clean games like they did. Three penalties, a very minimal pre-snap penalties, no turnovers, and keeping the ball that way. Another big, crap fest that happened, like a bad thing that happened was Cravion LeBlanc at punt returns. He's not a good punt returner. He may be all right once he catches the ball, but his decision-making back there of what he catches and what he doesn't leads a lot to be desired. And he left one to roll and put the Bears in some bad field position when he should just fair caught it. I love what the Bears did. And they, after all of this talk of, Fox is going to get fired and that there's a consultant in there evaluating everything and everybody's on the chopping block. The Bears, I forgot to mention that the rumors of John Fox absolutely hating Jay Cutler and not wanting him to play anymore, and Jay Cutler clearly acknowledging that without saying it in so many words in some press conferences where he said, well, he's got to deal with me. Is you have all these things, external things kind of floating around that are creating a bad environment for your team. And to see the guys at 1-6, they circle the wagons and they come out with this fantastic game. That just says that this team still has fight in them. And that bodes well for next year, even though you're going to get guys healthy. You're going to have the off season to add draft picks and to get free agents and to see guys fight still. And that just speaks volumes, and that's great to see. It's great to see them circle the wagons and come out with a big victory. They get the bye week this week to rest up, and hopefully they're going to get some guys back. Josh Sitton almost assuredly. They'll probably get Eddie Goldman back. Maybe Kyle Fuller, who knows? But they're going to get some guys back, and then in 2 weeks, they are going to be playing Tampa Bay Buccaneers, which is another winnable game. So right now they're 2-6, and after that game they could be 3-6, and suddenly they are bad, but they're not Cleveland Browns bad. So that's really going to wrap up what we had to talk about with the Bears. If you guys have anything you want to add about the Cubs or the Bears or the Blackhawks that we're going to be talking about, feel free to hit us up on the social media sites, Twitter at Swirsky Sports, Facebook.com/Swirsky Sports or SwirskySports.com. And we will answer your question, read your comment, even if it's something that you disagree with what I have to say. We're all sports fans. We should all be civil and treat each other with respect. The last thing I want to talk about is quickly is the Blackhawks haven't talked about them a lot, even though the season has been underway for the last couple weeks because the Cubs have been so deep in the playoffs. And the Blackhawks, and I'm sort of glad that we didn't talk about them because that penalty kill has been abysmal. It has been abysmal. And it's really kept them from winning more games. They've kind of been the opposite of the Chicago Blackhawks, where the Blackhawks, this is an or the Cubs, this is an October to remember. For the Blackhawks, this is an October to forget. You've had no Andrew Desjardins, which hurts your penalty kill. And even though it's been a rough month, you stand at third place in your division, which is, you're like, oh, that's not so bad. They've weathered that storm, stayed in third place. But if you look at the teams behind them, is a couple of them aren't going to be that bad for the rest of the season. They're going to find their groove because they're good teams. And you can't keep up the pace you're at riding the hot scoring streak of a Richard Panik. You can't do that. How long can that actually last? Now, if you look at the PK rate for the Blackhawks, they're only killing 53.1% of power plays. They're only killing a little more than half. And that's just awful. That's abysmal and atrocious. And you can't do that and expect to win games. You can't do that and expect to make the playoffs. You can't do that and expect to go anywhere in the playoffs if you were to sneak in. But the good news is that it seems like they're figuring things out. The game, I'm not going to talk about tonight's game because I didn't see it. I DVR'd it to watch it later, but World Series sort of took precedence over this. But the last game I watched was the Kings game, and they were 5-for-5 in killing penalties, which is great. So part of what they need to do is continue like what they've been doing the last few games with they're killing the penalties, and they've got to cut down on so many penalties. They can't give up all these opportunities of a man advantage, because even if you're fairly good at killing penalties, is giving them more opportunities is just stupid. And there's so many dumb penalties taking. What else? You saw the Blackhawks break up the top scoring line of Kane, Panarin, and Anisimov, and that trio, that line, has been basically a third of the Blackhawks' goals so far. They've been the driving force of their offense. But if you're the Blackhawks, you can't keep riding that line. It's like riding the hot streak of Richard Panik. Is you need that top line going. You need Jonathan Toews' offense going. Although even when he's not scoring, he's still a great player. You need some scoring from that line. So the Blackhawks did switcheroos, and they moved up Patrick Kane up to that line and Hossa down to the line with a Panarin and Anisimov. And you finally had Jonathan Toews get the back of the net for his first goal of the season, and that was Sunday. But it's kind of funny, is this big moment for Toews and getting that monkey off his back is how many people actually saw it, because it was during the World Series game, unfortunately. The Blackhawks power play is one of the top 10, one of the best in the league, which is the thing with the Blackhawks. They can't find a good balance of being good at penalty kills and being good at power plays. It's either they're great on penalty kills and they're atrocious on power plays, or they're great on power plays and atrocious at penalty kills. I don't know why they can't be good at one and find a nice balance of the other one, or be able to be good at both of those. It's mind-boggling. The face-offs for the Blackhawks has been bad. You've got Schmaltz, who's under 33%. Anisimov is just over 37%. And both of these guys are working with Yannick Perrault on improving that, but those are bad face-off percentages. Those are not good. You can't have that. Once the playoffs start, you can't be winning faceoffs at 30-some percent and expect to win games. Corey Crawford has looked outstanding as usual. You got to love him. We've got one of the best goaltenders in the league, although he's never going to get recognized as such. Hossa scored his 500th goal and got those honors, which was great to see. You're actually looking pretty good with this Panarin, Anisimov, and Hossa line. After two games, they look pretty good. You're seeing them transition to offense really quickly off of turnovers, and they look like they're meshing really well. And Hossa, you know, Hossa's acknowledged that, you know, it's a tough shoes for him to fill to replace Kane in that line, but I think it's actually a cool line with him on there. I kind of like it, and it's been fun to watch. Hjalmarsson's looked pretty rough for the last couple games, and I don't know if he's got some nagging injuries or what the case is, but I don't like to see that because he's one of the better defenders in the league, and you need him for a deep playoff run. What else? You've still got some injuries with Forsling is day-to-day with an upper body injury, and you've got a much more serious injury with Trevor van Riemsdyk, where he's going to be out 5 to 6 weeks with an upper body injury. And luckily, unlike last year's, you've got some depth at the defenseman spot. You know, you brought in Brian Campbell, and you've got Kempney, and you brought back Roosevelt, and you've actually got some decent depth there where, you know, you've had decent players be healthy scratches just because there's no spot at defenseman. And you even had Brian Campbell playing forward at one spot. But I want to talk quickly about Trevor van Riemsdyk. Is, you know, now that he's out with the injury, is he looked pretty good last season at limiting the opposing team's shots. So he was a very good defensive defenseman, but he's not good at puck movement. He's not good at generating offense. And those things is the Blackhawks need to be able to do. He's a guy that needs to be paired with a puck mover. And he's ultimately a third pairing kind of guy. He's not a top four defenseman, but in that third pairing, he's very good at what he does. When you have Trevor van Riemsdyk paired with Siebes, that's bad news. So you've got to pair him with somebody else to maximize what he's able to do. Let's see. Brian Campbell started off the season not so hot, and they've moved him to the right side, which is his weak side, and he seems to be thriving a lot more, although he's playing the right side, which is his weak side. You've got him playing with Duncan Keith, and that pairing has actually been very good. So the pairings right now with the injuries, you know, they'll shuffle a bit when Trevor van Riemsdyk comes back and when Gustav Forsling comes back. But you've got Duncan Keith paired with Soupy Campbell. You've got Michael Kempney with Brent Seabrook, and then you've got Hjalmarsson and Roosevelt. So, you know, it's actually some nice pairings. And now you're looking at, with your forwards, which you've had very little depth, that's been a big problem, the depth at forward. But your top line is Richard Panik on the left side, Taves and Kane as the right wing, Panarin, Anisimov, and Hossa, Tyler Mott, Nick Schmaltz, and Ryan Hartman is your third line, and then Hinostraza, Kruger, and Jordan Tutu, that bottom line. And Kruger has not been very good this season, and Jordan Tutu, is he ever going to score? So there's a lot of things that the Blackhawks, there are a lot of moving parts for the Blackhawks. They've got a lot of fresh young faces and inexperience that they need to get gelled in. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. And you're starting to see some of that turnaround a little bit, but the Blackhawks just need to keep progressing and getting better and getting better, because this is a long NHL season and you're not playing to be the best in the regular season, although sometimes it helps. You're just trying to get into the playoffs and be a well-oiled machine by the time they come around. So that's all I really have for this episode. Like I mentioned before, is if you guys want your comments read, or you have questions or concerns or hate mail or whatever the case may be, Hit us up on any of our social media, Twitter at Swirsky Sports, Facebook.com/Swirsky Sports, SwirskySports.com. And the website has all of the ways to get in touch with us. So thank you guys so much for listening. Please make sure that you are hitting subscribe on however you listen to us, whether it be iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube, and share this with your friends. And until next time, bear down.
We thank Ditka and God for all they have provided.
Cubs win!
Oh, I don't want her. You can have her. She's a Packer fan. She can't fit in my van.
And she looks like...
Remember, New Yorkers, smoking crack is not legal on the planes.
Bears 31 to negative 7.
The Bears!
Oh, when the bears go berry.